Okay, at this time, please help me welcome our speaker, Mike S. from Bristol.
Hey, everybody. My name is Mike Sykes, and I'm an alcoholic. Pretty excited to do this commitment. It's actually the first time that I'm driving myself to a commitment legally. I should probably watch what I say since I'm being recorded, but I don't think you use it against me. But I just recently got my license back. I was actually sharing with somebody a little bit before that. And for the whole time of my sobriety, the last 7 years, I haven't had a car or anything like that. Just got one recently. My fiance had just gotten her license restored. And, I have a 15-year-old stepson, I have a 5-year-old son, and a 3-year-old daughter. So you can imagine sometimes things are tough, with all that, especially when the kids are really young, doctor's appointments, going to the grocery store, going to work, stuff like that. And sometimes I've, butt my head against the wall, wanting to change it, thinking, I'm sober, I should have my license by now, wanting to orchestrate stuff. But it's doable, things like that. There's been a lot of hurdles, that I've had since I've gotten sober. But like they say, none of them is a good enough excuse or a reason to go drink again, to go back to that way of life. But one of the things that has never even had any of those things come into my mind and has kept pushing me forward, kept me energized about doing what's trying to do what's right. I mean, I'm not going to say I've never driven, and I've done some different things where I haven't been rigorously honest, and I've paid the price because of that, because I get to feel that and not try to hide my emotions with alcohol. But there's a loving God that guides me if I open my heart up to Him and if I ask for help, especially in those tough times. And I'm always carried through it, and I'm always shown, and I get this experience that there's nothing too big. So whatever your own personal thing is, I'm not trying to give you the Tony Robbins talk, but, whatever you're going through, nothing is my experience is nothing's too big with this program, especially when you have a God this big, that helped us all get here. So I recovered from alcoholism because I got a sponsor. My sponsor took me through those 12 steps. My sobriety date is March 12th of 2008, and I've been given a life where I can sit down with other guys and take them through the steps and watch their lives change, which is an amazing experience, especially for somebody coming into sobriety, into this program. And even sometimes in my own sobriety, getting into my head too much, and making things bigger than what they really are. To have that experience, to sit down with somebody and just give them a little bit of your time, even if it's not even taking them through the steps, just to listen to somebody, just to talk to them, just to try to ease their fear for the littlest bit. It moves me so much. I almost want to cry every time something like that happens. And that's a gift. It's such an amazing thing to be able to be there with somebody and just offer them that, just yourself, just your time. So don't ever think that you don't have anything to give. I mean, just listening to somebody is an amazing thing. I work at a treatment center, and part of my job is I'm an intake counselor, and I listen, to people on the phones and listen to the parents. The parents are crying their eyes out, and they're scared to death, and they don't know what to do. And the people come in, and they're shaking, and some of the young people, even some of the older people who've never been to treatment before, never been to AA meeting, never done any of this stuff. And to be able to be in a place today, it was given, I was given that gift to be able to be there and just to stand up for this program. Just to be an example, something that they can see, that they can touch. Because I've had moments even in my sobriety where I think, is God real? Am I keeping myself sober? Am I even really an alcoholic? I get too far away from my sponsor, I'll start judging him. He's this and that, whatever. I get away from other people, I'd start judging people in the fellowship. And I completely forget that this whole program allows me to be a person that can help other people. I think sometimes I get it twisted, and I think people in the world or people in the fellowship are everything, and I forget all about the program. And the program is key because it helps me to be there with them, not to rely on them or have to change anything, not have to change anybody in my life. And those are some of the biggest gifts that I've been given, because of this program. So thanks to Rich for asking me to come up. It's an amazing thing. It's just really cool to be able to be here and be a representative and just tell you what's happened, tell you what God's done in my life. So I started drinking when I was 16, and that was like kind of late compared to most of my friends. Most of my friends were experimenting with a whole bunch of different stuff, and I was always afraid. And I remember going around the block to my friend's house and pretending to drink. Like they were all getting wasted and smoking weed, doing all this stuff. And they gave me, I think they were drinking Yingling or something. They gave me like a beer, and I walk down the street and I pour it out into the creek down the street from the house. And then I come back like, you know, swaying in the street like, hey guys, like screaming and stuff and trying to act like I'm drunk, you know, like a weirdo. And, but I'm like trying to act because I'm already like trying to just like fit in like everybody, you know, and I think a lot of us, you know, we have that thing where we say, at some point, I just felt like I didn't fit. And at that time, I'm going through puberty. I think anybody going through puberty doesn't fit. Like, that's just kind of like what happens. You don't fit. You literally don't fit in your body. Your body's growing. You feel weird. Everybody feels self-conscious. You know, you got like all this crazy stuff going on. And, you know, I went down to the shore with a couple friends of mine, and they were drinking. A couple of the girls, they were with, you know, the boyfriends who were of legal age and stuff. And so we had it planned out. We were going to drink. And I was always scared. Like the reason why I faked drinking, like with my friends before that, is because I was scared to death of putting any of this stuff in my body because of my relationship with my mom, you know. And my mom's like, you know, I was raised Roman Catholic, and we'd go to church every Sunday, and I was an altar boy. And I loved doing that stuff. I was excited. Like, I remember when I was 12, I wasn't like old enough to be an altar boy, but I watched them, and I watched for like when they ring the bell. It was like almost like this audition. Like, I was like excited about doing that one day. And then I got a chance to do that. I would go to, I was like getting crammed with Catholic stuff, and I would go to Catholic school. And I would go to CCD. If anybody knows what CCD is, it's like this Catholic school after hours for people who are in public school. But I was going to CCD and Catholic school at the same time. You know, so it was like really being, you know, hit home. But the way it was brought to me, I didn't really have a whole bunch of like objections towards it. I'm a young kid too, so it's just being given to me. I just kind of take it for what it is. But my mom used to read to me different spiritual stuff, and she would teach me how to pray. And when I did it, even as a young kid, I remember feeling different. I remember having like these experiences when I tried to pray. And she used to say stuff to me like my mom was like serious about this stuff. Like she would say, you have to love God more than you love me. And being a little kid, I didn't understand that. And then now as I'm older and, you know, kind of like, you know, stopped drinking and woke up a little bit, it makes perfect sense. And I understand what she was getting at. And I'm really thankful for that, you know, but so I was like really afraid to kind of go against the grain. You know, really I was afraid that my mom would find out because she was like, you know, she's 74 now. So she was more old school. So if I went, you know, against the grain, I get it, you know. So I was afraid of that. She was really big with driving around the corner and chasing me down with the wiffle ball bat and stuff like that. But I didn't want her to find out about nothing. And I guess I kind of had this like thought, like, you know, I'm going down to the shore. I'm going to be miles away from home. My mom's not going to find out. You know, I'm not going to get in trouble with her. And if she doesn't know, she can't tell God, you know, and then I won't go to hell when I die, you know, because we just got done reading Dante's Inferno that year in ninth grade. And like, hell was like a bad idea. You know, it just didn't sound like a good place to go to. And the impression I was getting is like, if I drank, if I had sex before I was married, if I got tattoos, which I'm, you know, got a whole bunch of them now, do any drugs, any of this kind of stuff, you know, then I'm going to, you're basically like, there's supposed to be these classes of sins. There's supposed to be like mortal sins and then venial sins. And with my mom, everything was a mortal sin. Everything was like bad. You're going to hell if you do it. So I try to stay on the straight and narrow as much as I can. She brought me up good, you know, to the best that she could. And I tried to do everything that, you know, the way she wanted me to do it. And then I'm 16. We go down to the shore and we start drinking. And, you know, and I feel funny and I'm real nervous and I'm self-conscious. And I really started to, at this point, like really started to withdraw. And this is where I really started to isolate. And for the whole year, this is at the end of the ninth grade year. The whole year in like ninth grade, I wouldn't leave my house. I tried to go to the mall before with my friend. And it's like this two-tier mall. It's called the Oxford Valley Mall down by where I live. And I, you know how like you lock eyes with somebody and like maybe you had this kind of thing where you think that they're all looking at you. And then you see somebody and you're like, and they're looking at you, you know, for that split second. You're like, oh, that was it. And that confirmed it. Like I had that experience in the mall with somebody like up on the top tier. And I really felt like people were like staring at me. I was like so self-conscious and so just crazy in my head. And some of my friends who were non-alcoholic, they said they had similar feelings like that, you know. So I think that's kind of the thing where I don't really separate myself from all people. I think we all kind of get like that. But what happened to me that was different was we went down there and we started to drink, and I had that experience from the first time I drank that I've had every single time after that, you know, where the thing where you can breathe, you know, the thing where you start to forget about like that fear, the social anxiety, the paranoia. And something else was going on where this thing started to kick up that I didn't realize at the time. But looking back, I realize and learning about alcoholism and seeing how I progressed. But I started to drink and I just would not stop, you know, and because it did like so much stuff for me at that time. Like I forget about the social fear. I forget about the paranoia. There's these girls that are there that I think are cute, but I'm so deathly afraid of ever even looking at a girl. And now I'm like cracking jokes. I think I'm a comedian. You know, I feel like fine. My dad was never in my life and from like when I was 3 months old on. And I completely forgot I ever even had a dad. There was no, who cares? There's no dad issues. You know, everything was gone. Every single problem I've ever manifested in my life at that point was taken away. And then on top of that, I'm drinking and, you know, I'm just jumping around. I'm like, I'm finally free. You know, my friends are trying to catch me. I'm throwing rocks at them. They're saying, chill, the cops are going to come. I'm like maybe like this tall, you know, for those listening on tape, that's like 4 foot. But and I think like all of a sudden they're like, the cops are going to come. I'm like, screw the cops. I'll fight them all. And like, you know, I turn into the Incredible Hulk, or as my fiance used to call me, the Incredible Bulk. And I'm just like nuts in my head. And I completely think I'm like somebody other than who I really am. And like, you know, and I never even like really did much with anybody or any girls or anything at that time. And like girls are walking by with their boyfriends. And, you know, even if they're the big Jersey Shore guy, I'm screaming at them, yo, come up here, you know, come party with me. And if they came up, I wouldn't even know what to do with them. You know, I never even been with a girl at that time. And if the boyfriend followed up, he would toss me off the balcony, you know. But none of this stuff matters. Like nothing matters. I have no problems. I find this answer, you know, I have one substance for all problems in my life, you know, one answer. And so what I do is I keep drinking, but I'm going back and we had the little red party cups, you know, and everything is like pre-mixed. We made this like, you know, top shelf Vladimir, like jungle juice thing or whatever. And I'm going back and I'm grabbing the vodka bottle now and I'm spiking my own drink because whatever this stuff is, whatever this thing is that I'm feeling, like I want more of it. Like I can't not have this thing. And, you know, I don't even know. I guess, like, thank God I was with the other people because I probably would have had alcohol poisoning and died had I been drinking by myself. And there have been many times that I've gotten myself to that point. But, you know, here I am, and I'm thankful for that. But so that's, like, my experience with drinking. And I've always gone back to it, you know, much like probably most of us. I don't know if you've ever drank. Maybe you've drank once or twice here. But like it's like I always go back to it. Like it's just I just need it. It's this I have this desperation when I'm not with it, you know. It's like this really bad relationship and I'm so entitled, you know. And it just everything gets bad, you know. Things progress like with all of us, you know. And I was 19. I like just barely somehow graduated high school. I had to go to this alternative school, and that was a whole mess thing because I get hooked up with these other kids that are kicked out of school and kicked out of their houses, and they're doing all this other stuff. So I'm grabbing onto that too, and it's escalating. I keep finding new people, you know, who are either where I want to go, like as far as my disease goes, or are where I'm at. You know, I meet people at my level, you know, and it keeps getting worse and worse and worse, and one of the things that happened, one of these like jaw-dropping, like shake-me-up moments was I was with this girl after I graduated, and, you know, we're always butting heads. You know, it was the whole like I was like the rebound after her like relationship thing. And for me, I was like just this crazy possessive kid. I love you and I hate you. I love you and I hate you, you know, all that and breaking up every other week. And one of the times we broke up, she's calling me and I'm, you know, I got the old Nokia cell phone thing and I remember hitting end, not answering. Finally answered, like, what do you want? And she's like, I'm pregnant. You know, and I felt like the whole everything, I was on my way to this party. I felt like the party just stopped, you know, the car stopped, everything. And I was scared to death because I'm 19. I never had my dad in my life. You know, I'm not supposed to be getting any girls pregnant. You know, I'm not even supposed to be having sex or nothing like that. It's probably like it was like almost like the first time I'm like having sex. Some girl's already pregnant. You know, my luck. You know, whatever. But and I have no idea what to do. I don't even know how to like live my life. I don't know how to be a father. I don't know how to do anything. But you know, I try to like somehow think in my head like, all right, I'm gonna put it together. And well, my mom's like really against abortion and all that stuff. So you know, that's out of the picture. So you know, I figure I'm gonna do this. I'm gonna you know, what I did is I played that for a little bit. And, you know, as she's getting further along, I'm coming over to, I'm living at my mom's house. She's living at her parents' house, you know, like anybody else who has their life put together. And, you know, I'm coming over to her house and rubbing her belly as she's getting further along. And then my daughter's born and, you know, we're playing with her and doing the tummy time stuff on the mat. And all throughout this time, like I'd come over to the house, like I was like one of the only guys who was able to sleep over her house. And the parents let us because, you know, we're having this kid and all this stuff. Probably felt bad for me because it was crazy. And I'm like there at the house and wanting to be with her and wanting to be with my daughter. But I would make up these things. Like, I was never really allergic to anything in her house, but I remember making up this thing like, oh, I'm allergic all of a sudden to your dogs because I got to go home and I got to go drink, you know. And around this time, I'm like getting my hands into all this other stuff that she's not down with me doing. But I do this stuff where I make up stuff. And then we wound up moving in together. I had gotten in this car accident. I broke both of my legs, my couple ribs, my wrist. And as soon as I got out of the hospital, we had this apartment and we're living together. And I would cause fights with her so I could go out and go drink because she didn't want to have alcohol in the house. And primarily because she saw how I got, like even at that point, like I go drink with her friends and like I was the guy with two 40s. You know, I always had like, you know, this stockpile just in case, like, you know, the world ended. It was kind of like thing. And it was just nuts, like how I would drink and people would see that. But I was so like, I couldn't see it. You know, I didn't care to see it. Because, you know, I didn't want them to take it away from me. And so I'm causing fights with her so I can go out and drink. It gets to the point where it's like the periods of time where I'm away from my daughter become longer and longer and longer until the point where now I'm in the court system and I'm getting locked up. And about a year after that car accident, I get this accident settlement. And it's like for $230,000 after the lawyer and what got paid back to the health insurance and all this stuff because I had these crazy surgery. I got like metal rods all in me and stuff. I'm like the Terminator. And I got like $103,000 handed to me in this check. You know, I remember like being like blown away at this thing. And I spent that in like 9 months, you know, and I wish it was to say like I got my daughter this, you know, IRA and like did all this different stuff, but I didn't. You know, I got a stolen street bike, two cars that I crashed, you know, one got impounded one of the times I got locked up, and, you know, a whole lot went to my alcoholism. And that really helped me get further along. It helped me get to AA quicker, you know, that money. But now I'm in and out of jail. You know, I'm getting locked up. And I'm getting to this place where it's like in and out, in and out. And I just hate who I am. You know, I don't have nothing going on. I work these crappy little jobs like here and there. And I only keep them for a little bit of time until I like get tired of it or they fire me. Or just I'm big with just not showing up. You know, it's a mutual understanding for both parts. It's a pretty civil way, at least for somebody like me. So, you know, and I have nothing going on. And I got friends that are going off to college and they're developing the 5-year plan. And my 5-year plan is how do I stay out of Bucks County Prison, you know, the local jail? Because I'm in and out and in and out. And I just hate who I am. And I get to this point where my PO does me a favor and she calls me. And I wouldn't answer it. I'm like scared to death. I got towards the end of my drink and I'm drinking like a liter of vodka a day and I'm going to my mom's purse, stealing her Valium and taking like 130 milligrams of them and just so I'm not here, you know. And around this time, I'm drinking so much. I like did something. I guess I shut my kidneys down. I don't even know what I did, but I woke up one morning and I couldn't go to the bathroom and I'm like trying, I'm pushing, you know, you're drinking like all night and like your bladder's like full and it hurts so bad. And I'm standing there and like nothing's happening. I'm like, oh crap. And it was that thing, that classic line that I say to myself, what did you do now? What did you do? Like, and it's a quick scramble. Like, what is it? Blame it on something else, you know? And I go up to this urologist and they had to catheterize me. If you don't know what that is, I'll explain it to you after the meeting. But it's not fun and it hurts really bad. And but I had this thing in me and I remember going back home and I literally thought in my head like, well, this isn't that bad because now, you know, I don't have to get up as much to go to the bathroom. You know, I can just sit here and drink and watch TV. Like, this is how crazy I am at this point. I'm nuts. Like, I'm just a nutball. And I have it in for like about a week. I go back to the urologist and they're like, all right, we're going to try to take it out and see, you know, what you could do. I go drink one of them rock stars and they always help me go to the bathroom like as soon as I like sipped it. And I went to the bathroom and I'm like, yeah, all right. So now I'm good. I don't have to have it in anymore. So like I have this track record for like, you know, celebrating. Like I always drink like whenever something really good happens, something really bad happens. You know, it's like it's Tuesday, it's Monday night, like whatever it is. Like I drink and I'm celebrating. So I go back and I'm slamming. You know, my thing was like those big, you know, 7-Eleven cups. I get the biggest one I could get. I'd throw some pineapple soda and, you know, some top shelf Vladimir together and drink that. And I'm back in the next night having another catheter put in me. And now I'm kind of like, all right, this is kind of like crazy. Like, you know, but I don't have enough sense or I don't have the power to say to myself that, you know, maybe this alcohol thing is a problem. I still couldn't get to that place by myself yet. And, you know, I'm riding my bike all around because my license is suspended. I'm talking to this girl and she's like, you know, about to like push me away because she sees how crazy I am. And I get locked up for the last time. And my PO basically says to me, do yourself a favor and turn yourself into the local turn yourself into the jail. And it was the second time that I heard, you know, once during this DUI and now from her, she's like, you know, your toxicology report came back and I don't even know how you're alive. Like, you shouldn't even be breathing. And there's like stuff in there. I don't even know what it is, you know, because I'm like using inhalants and I'm just nuts, you know. And I just hate who I am. And like that's what I have to look forward to. I'm out on the street for like a couple months, and I just know somewhere deep down inside that inevitably I'm going to go back to jail again. I just kind of know, like that's all I have to look forward to in life. And that's like such a crappy way to live. And I remember that misery. And I'm drinking all day long, and right before my PO goes and calls me and tells me this, I get wasted the one day, and I'm like MacGyver when I drink. You know, I come up with these great ideas, like to put stuff together. I think I'm like the scientist or something. I do it with like food and like, you know, electronics or whatever. So one day I'm like MacGyver in my mom's computer, trying to hook it up to my TV, and I drop it and I like crack her screen and crack the whole thing apart. But I'm just laying there on the ground, and she comes up to me like, just flowing, like just crying so hard. She's like, what are you doing to yourself? You're killing yourself. What are you doing? And I start screaming at her. And I tell her, get back, get the F away from me. I threw like a coaster at her to try to get her back away from me. And this is my mom. Like, it was just she and I growing up. You know, my dad was out of the picture, like I said, when I was 3 months old. She did every single thing that she could within her power to help me and to raise me the best that she could. Especially she had, you know, I have two other sisters and a brother who's like constantly in and out of jail. He's got like a lot of issues. My one sister's got a lot of stuff going on. And, she has a lot, you know, a lot that she's trying to juggle. And now she's got me and trying to take care of me. And here I am. You know, I used to have this mentality, like if anybody ever said anything bad to my mom or like, you know, had tried to mistreat her, like I would destroy him, you know, go after him. And I'm treating her worse than anybody that I've ever known to. You know, that I've ever witnessed. I'm the number one offender, you know. And she leaves her own house, and she was gone for 2 days, and then she called me, you know, and she said, I'm coming back to the house, and I know you got a warrant, and I'm coming back with a cop, so if you don't want to get locked up, get out of my house. So, you know, like any other courageous alcoholic, I get on my pedal bike, and now I'm riding all around, and now I'm homeless, and sleeping on wherever I can go, and and I'm just nuts. I just hate who I am. And then my PO gives me that call. It says, do yourself a favor and turn yourself into the jail. And I don't even know where it came from, but somehow this light bulb went off. And I was in this this treatment center when I was 19. And it was right after my daughter was born. And I was in there because at the time I couldn't get alcohol. I'm 19 years old. So if I couldn't get it, my friends wouldn't buy it for me. I'd go into the lawnmower shed and I'd go grab some like carburetor spray or something that says it's going to kill you if you breathe it in and throw that on a sock and just like, you know, inhale it. And because I just need to get out of here. You know, I just can't be here and I hate myself, even though like I'm only 19, like not a whole lot of bad stuff's gone down in my life, but I just don't feel like I want to be here. And I tell my mom because I'm waking up in the morning and I'm like having to do it the first time I get up and I'm shaking really bad and almost like the alcohol tremors that I would get at the end. And they got me in, they 302'd me into this dual diagnosis unit. And I'm in there and I'm 19 and I don't have a problem. And I'm laughing at the people like, you know, who are crying their eyes out saying they got to go to long-term treatment away from their families and all this stuff. I'm like, just stop. Just stop drinking. What are you crying about? Like, I could stop. Just stop. Stop doing it. And just like a punk, arrogant kid. And, you know, because I don't know. And so I get out of that place. I'm talking to this girl while I'm in there. I didn't even hear that there were 12 steps. I didn't even hear about anything while I was in there. But I remembered that you got to wear your own clothes, the food was pretty good, and you were in there with girls. So I was like, all right, all I have to look forward to is jail. This is a lot better. So maybe I'll like try to weasel my way into there, and maybe I can get that thing that they were talking about when the last time I was locked up, time served. You know, apparently you can go to these different places and like get out of it, weasel out of jail. And it kind of worked out to my benefit, kind of, because I'm here. But I got 30 days in that treatment center, and then I had to do 60 days in jail afterwards. And, you know, I was doing the – I was like the poster child for self-pity while I was in there. They were asking us – it was the dual diagnosis unit. And, you know, we had to do these contracts for safety every single day, saying you're not going to harm yourself or anyone else. They said, how's your mood? I'm like, bad. I'm like, what do you have to look forward to? I'm like, nothing. I got to go to jail after this. I mean, my life sucks, like all this stuff. And it was just like I was just so full of it, so full of just crap, you know. But this one, like, miracle would happen. This guy would come in, this old dude, and he'd do these AA presentations. And I remember getting so irritated at this guy because he had the same, like, punchline joke every time he came in to start. Because the treatment thing, it was like I kept stretching out. They were, like, saying, all right, do you feel like you're ready to leave yet? And I'm, like, trying to not go to jail. So I'm like, no, I think I'm going to harm myself. You know, so I turned, like, a week, like, week and a half, like, thing because it's really just a detox into, like, a month. And so I got to see this guy, like, four times, you know, more than everybody else. And he'd come in and he had this thing. He's like, you know, I'm just like all you guys in here. The only difference between me and you is I still have my shoelaces on. He'd have this belly laugh. Oh, and he's like, and I'm like, this guy in this joke with the shoelaces, like, I hate you. Like, and thank God for this dude, because one of the things he would always come in and talk about is he always say this S word, get a sponsor. You know, go through the 12 steps, get a sponsor, get this guy to take you through these steps. Sponsor, sponsor, sponsor. When you get out to your first meeting, raise your hand and say, hey, I'm new, out of treatment, and I need a sponsor. And if you can't do that, go to the chair of the meeting and tell them, hey, I need a sponsor. And like, this is like, you know, another language to me, because I've never been to AA meetings. Like, this is my first time ever trying AA meetings and getting this sponsor and doing these steps and all this stuff. And I've been able to stay because I just did it, you know. But I got in and I just, this stuff like got burnt in my head. And I'm in jail, you know, for that 60 days. And I'm like, you know, number one AA person on the block. Like, I'm going to the meetings. It's not just to get off the block, you know, and go talk to somebody and exchange commissary or whatever. I really want to be there. I don't even know what they have to offer or what's going on. But I just know that there's something about this thing that I just already like. And I get out of jail and I'm paroled to this recovery house. Never been to a recovery house. Didn't even know what I was getting into. And I walk into the place and there's like 12 dudes just sitting there and they're watching TV and stuff. And I'm like thinking like, all right, got to be on guard. Like, what are they going to want to get from me? Who are these people? And they would just come up like one by one. And, you know, one guy's asking me, hey, you want to go through the steps? And I'm like, what the hell? What's the steps? Like, what are you talking about? And they were asking me, hey, do you need any clothes? Hey, you hungry? You want something to eat? And these people, like, I didn't know who they were. And they were just like, even before they said anything, there was something there. They just came to me before they even used words. There was just something that I could feel coming into this house. And we go to these meetings, and I went to like, I think one or two meetings before we went to this big book study. And this guy, Chris, is doing this big book study. He does it for the houses. And, you know, he's saying all this different stuff and I have no clue what the heck he's talking about. And, then what he does is something that he usually does. He starts talking about himself and things that he did, and he starts relating what he's reading in the book to his own practical experience. And that makes more sense to me, and I can understand what he's saying. But more than that, more than all the words, I felt it. Like something, it was almost like this direct line, and he was like telling me stuff that I just bought into. And like, I feel like that right now. Like, I know what you're talking about. Like, and I want to feel better. And he always was leading it with hope. And they closed out the meeting, and this guy, he came up, and he was the chair of the meeting, and he actually owned the recovery house I was in. So I'm like thinking like, all right, I'm going to do it. You know, because I'm in this room and there's maybe like 20, 30 people in the meeting. And I'm like sitting like dead center in the meeting. And I've thought about like raising my hand. And you know how like when you're new and you want to like raise your hand in the meeting, you get that like your stomach starts churning and stuff. Like I felt like all the like that there was like 5,000 people in this room. And I cannot – if I raise my hand, everybody's going to look at me. That's my number one fear right now. And I can't do that. So I went up to this dude and I said to him, Scott, you know, I'm new in these houses of yours. Like, do you know where I can get this sponsor thing? I probably didn't even think I was saying it right. And he was all like pumped and he's like, I'll sponsor you. And he's all excited. Like he's got this new guy, you know, now I get it, you know, but, And I was just like blown. I'm like, oh, cool. This dude owns the house. He's got to know something about some of this stuff. And he just got me right into the steps, you know. And it took a really, really long time for me to get through the steps. It was like 6 weeks. That was a joke. But in that time, you know, and like, you know, there's a lot of different thoughts and theories or whatever. I don't know. My big book doesn't really say too much as a time frame. And there's a lot of energy about like, let's like not at least delay it. You know, let's kind of get into this stuff because there's an amazing experience that's going to come about doing this stuff and just trying it. Even each and every step. I remember the first time I was in a meeting and I rose my hand and said in my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting that I was an alcoholic. Even that felt like uplifting. That it felt weird saying it, but there was something to that. There was a little bit of surrender in that. And each time I've given up myself just to do these things, to take these steps, try to apply these principles, even if I don't fully understand it. That's why I got a tour guide. I don't have to get the whole thing. Like he just kind of carries me through it. I've had so many different people who've come to me over the years and just helped me and guided me through. So long as I'm open, I keep my eyes open and I look, they're all around. With all different sobriety dates, all different times, all different looks and colors and whatever. Like, there's so much that's out there. If I'll just throw aside my thought of what I think should happen, like that prayer we said in the beginning of the meeting, and just ask God, like, what is it you want me to see? What is it? I don't even know. Sometimes that's like the best prayer. I don't know, and thank you. Some of the best prayers I think I've ever prayed. But He just guided me through this stuff, and I just did it. And, you know, because what else did I have? What did I really have to lose, you know? So I'm going through these steps, and I'm like, you know, scared to death about telling him anything. But, you know, little by slowly, I'm telling him more and more and more. And we get to the amends, and I'm going out, and I'm making these amends. And initially, in the beginning, I'm making some amends that, you know, obviously I'm going to have to remake, you know, because I'm kind of like saying some stuff. But my actions aren't really following through with it. And I'm learning more about rigorous honesty and really practicing the principles in all my affairs. And if I stay sober and I stay connected with these people, then I have all these opportunities to make the best amends possible, you know, an ongoing one with them. But I get honest with some people and I get honest about some stuff and who I was. And this amazing experience came from that. I let go of, you know, this pretend life that I thought who I thought I was. I let go of this egotistical view of myself and who I think I am to these people and what these people did to me. You know, I allowed other people the right to be wrong. And in doing that and letting them off the hook, I got free. And there was so much paying people back their money, you know, but it's not about mine. Giving them back to theirs. And then I don't have to ignore the phone call. I don't have to run or hide from anybody. You know, and I start to live this way that, like, even the people I haven't met yet at this point who maybe I tried to make an approach to, who I was deathly afraid to see, I'm making these amends and I'm just doing it just because this is what's right. It feels right. This feels like where I should be. This feels like what I should be doing. And as I'm doing it, even the people I haven't met yet, my fear of meeting with them starts to go away because I kind of start to see what this whole thing's about. And I keep getting rid of more and more of this crap that's getting in the way of my happiness. And I keep feeling more and more of this freedom that they keep promising me and telling me about. And I'm going back through and I'm reading through the big book with sponsees and like I'm watching them and they're like feeling like they're blown away. And I'm blown away because now each sentence is making more and more sense as time's going on. It means something different every single day that I go back into it. And I'm just having these experiences that are really just changing my life. And I'm becoming a good employee now, a better employee, you know, like I'm trying to practice stuff and trying to come to work on time. And I wind up going back with to this girl that I was with, the one who was like about to just pushing me away, keeping me at arm's length. And I made this amends with her, and we got back together, and wound up getting a place together, and wound up getting engaged. You know, and I went back, and you know, on top of just it wasn't a whole bunch of like saying stuff like, yeah, I'm sorry that I called you these names, and I'm sorry that you know I did this and did that. You can say a whole bunch, but like the steps helped me to be somebody different. God helped me to show up and to wear a whole different suit and to be with her so long as I kept asking him for help. And because of him, I was able to keep this relationship. We've been together now for 8 years, and that like blows my mind. I've had the same cell phone number for the last 7 years, which is like crazy. You know, like you can actually hold on to stuff. Like it's amazing like what you can actually retain. But it's not about stuff, but it's about these experiences. Like as time goes on, they just get bigger and bigger and deeper, and they mean more, and your heart grows even bigger. And even when you don't think, like, you think like everything is as best as it's going to be, and it gets that much better, you know, 5 minutes later even, or the next day, so long as I'm seeking, you know, and I'm really open and willing to see it. But we get back together, and I feel like all this. I've never felt like this way towards somebody, and now I'm sober too, so I can actually feel, you know. And she's like amazing. Like she never really had this like set conception of God or whatever, but she just believed in like the universe and the spirit. And like I feel like even to this day, like she practices like spirituality way better than I do. And there was just something that like I was always gravitated. We have like the same kind of sense of humor and stuff too, and like. She's just awesome, and I'm thinking like I want to propose to her, you know, I want to be with her forever, and but I have no ideas, like I don't know what to do. I'm like so nervous just at the thought of it, and I'm on Facebook, and it was old school Facebook with all those like things on the side, the advertisements, and like they stalk you, so if you like search for something, they throw like an advertisement related to your search in the thing, and I'm looking up like wedding rings, engagement rings. And this thing comes up and it says, are you looking for an interesting way to propose? I click on it. I'm like, yeah, because I got no ideas whatsoever. And it's this thing for this playhouse down by where we live now. It's called the Bristol Riverside Theater. And they were looking for a couple couples to propose after their main show. The show was great. It was called I Love You, You're Perfect, Now Change, which is great. You know? And they're like, we're looking for a couple of people like to come up, and after the whole play's over and everything else, you're going to get up there and propose to your person and all that stuff. I'm like, oh my God, like this is it. This is so awesome. Like I could never do anything like this on my own. Like everything's just being put together. And all the while, I'm still like kind of have that alcoholic thinker where I'm like, nah, I don't know if I could do it. And like God's got the mouse going and click, click, and I'm moving forward. And I get on the phone with the lady. And I'm in the jewelry store and I'm buying the ring. And then before I know it, we're outside of the theater house. And I'm posting Facebook statuses like, you know, if you like it, then you better put a ring on it. And like she's asking me to use the phone. And I'm lying, like, oh, my phone's not working, whatever. And we get back into the thing and like I'm so excited. Like I'm the worst at like secrets, too. And like I want to tell her so bad, but thank God I didn't. And we get in there and I told her beforehand, I'm like, get dressed up because they're going to have like the local news stuff and all that there. And they're going to pick two people to come up and they're going to win like season passes and stuff after the thing. Like, I'm like trying to give it away. I'm like, wouldn't that be so cool if we did that? If we won that? She's like, yeah, I guess so. Yeah, whatever. And like just kind of shrugging me off like she usually does. And, the play's over and they're like, all right, we have one more exciting thing. They're like, would Mike Sykes come up to the stage? And I look at her and she's like, mouse, shut the fuck up. Like that. Like her face is like dropped. She couldn't believe it. And, we get up there and, they're asking me like how the show was. I'm like super nervous. They give me a microphone. It's like down here the whole time. And I look at her and like I start saying like, oh, I love how you are with our son. And, like, and I start crying. She starts crying. I get down on my knee and it was like I couldn't even hear anything. And all I hear is this dude in the audience like, all right, like that. And then they're all clapping. And it was this amazing experience. And they videotaped it. They put it on YouTube for us and like gave us this little disc and all that. Gave us the season passes and stuff. And thanks to sobriety, you know, thanks to this program, I was able to live a way of life up until that point that allowed me to be that person to do that. You know, I was able to, even when I'm not trying to, put these things together. Because really, God is orchestrating all these things when I'm not watching or when I don't notice. And I just show up and I just throw up my hands, throw in the towel, and there it is. And he lays it all out. It's always been like that, time and time again. Especially when I'm so doubtful and I don't know how something's going to work out. It's like always at the end, after all of that stress I put myself through unnecessarily, I get to a place after it's all said and done, and I have an experience, I have this lesson that came from it, and I have this profound, this knowing. The only thing I really know is like that God is real, that God really is there when I least expect it, you know, even when I doubt, and I'm just carried through it. And so it was just an amazing experience, and we live together with my son and my daughter and my stepson, and I'm able to be a dad today, you know. And I never thought like that, you know, because I never had my dad around. I had no idea what it was to be a father or any of that stuff, and I'm able to do that. Like I can actually be the type of person. Like it's an amazing thing when I can come home and my kids are excited, you know, and they're saying like daddy, and they're running, and you know, like one of those like old movies, you know, when they go to pick up their dad from work. And But that's if I stay spiritually fit, because I mean, I've had times in my sobriety where like I'm starting to go off course and anger starts coming up and like, and you know, who am I around the most? My family. And I take it out on them. And that's not who I want to be. And you know, I'm thankful that I have somebody in my life. I have her, my fiance in my life, who kick me in the butt and say like, this is unacceptable. You need to get back to doing the work. And I'm really grateful for that. You know, that God puts these people in my life. Even my kids, like my son, like, he's five. He's about to be six, you know, on the 15th. And like this kid, if I'm willing to listen, you know, and to watch, he teaches me so much. Because I, you know, there's nothing that I wouldn't do for my kids, you know, like, and I kind of think about it. Like I have these moments where I stop and I think about stuff and I think like, if I feel this way towards my son, like what stops me from feeling that way towards a stranger? You know, why do I have this blockage? Why do I have this thought like that, you know, he deserves this kind of love or this treatment and then this person doesn't, you know, my judgment. And it just totally, cause the experiences I have with him are like awesome and I'm always smiling no matter what we do together. And I have the opportunity to have those experiences with every single person I meet if I drop that judgment. But, you know, I still have that judgment. I still, you know, like we're not saints, you know, all that kind of stuff, but I have a way of life that where I practice it like here and there, and I've experienced it. I could stand up here and tell you that when I let go of that stuff, when I'm really tapped in, when I really like am asking God, like just show me, just use me for today. What do you want me to do? And then I remind myself constantly why I'm here, like just alive. It's like the best days I've ever had in my life. It's constantly being surrounded by my kids. It's just, it's in a place where nothing is wrong. I've had those moments. I've had long periods, like long, almost whole days where, you know, before I had my license, right, riding my bike to work in the rain and crying because I'm so grateful for what I actually have. And thinking about riding my bike to go to one of the recovery houses to go sponsor somebody and crying because I'm so excited that I get to have that experience. Or coming back from working with this guy or sitting there crying with him. Being at my job and like being to be able to be with a patient for just that moment and like you just see like something changes in them. Their spirit gets a little bit lighter and having to run off to the bathroom and get on my knees and just say thank you. Like those experiences are always there. They're just waiting for me. And I shut the door on it. I walk past it. But if I practice these principles, they show up left and right. And you know, I've had a bunch of like just these pow, like shot moments, you know, where God puts stuff together for me that like, it's just blown away. There's no words for it. Like case in point, my dad, you know, who I never knew, he like called my house one time and when I was a little kid, my mom got on the phone. I remember wanting to talk to him and, she got in an argument with him and hung up and that was it. And then, so he wrote me this letter like a little while later, quite a few years later. And I think it was like 17 or 18. It was like back in 2001. And when I first read the letter, I was, you know, I'm drinking, I'm anything I can get my hands on, I'm a mess, I'm crazy, you know, I told you guys what I did, you know, I'm nuts. And I don't see anything the right way. I only see things as it affects me and whatever, all that stuff. So I'm reading this letter, and he's telling me in the letter about his life now, and that he found his higher power, and he said, my Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. And like, that's all I picked up out of the letter. And somehow I concocted into this thing, oh, this dude's trying to tell me about God and I need to find God so I could be happy. Who are you? Like, I grew up, you know, I know about God. Like, I got straight A's in religion class, you know, like, you ain't gonna tell me nothing. Where were you at? You know, I hate this guy. I'm like angry. And, what he was doing is he was trying to write me this letter, this last ditch effort, because he had gotten, cancer and it was like in his lungs, spread all over his body. He had to have half of his lung removed and he died like about 3 months after writing me that letter. And when I read it, I was so filled with like anger and fear and all this like nasty negativity, just darkness. And I thought like I ripped it up. I could have sworn like I burned it or something, you know, I don't even know. And, you know, I've moved, I don't even know how many times, like to Philly, to this place, at that place, couch hopping, like wherever I could find a place, in and out of jail. Like I never wind up in the next place with the same two pairs of socks. Like I always lose everything. And, I'm cleaning my house out. Man, these bugs are vicious out here. It's like a kamikaze. I'm cleaning my house out, and like about a year and a half, almost 2 years ago now, cleaning out this end table thing I have, and I pick up this little letter, and it's that letter from my dad. And this is like back in 2001. The thing's like all like old and kind of beat up. And I couldn't believe it. Like, I'm like, how did this get here? Like, I could have sworn I destroyed this thing. I took it to a wood chipper or something. And immediately I rifle into it and I open it up and I'm reading it. And now I can actually read it. Now I actually really see what he said. And he was telling me, like, didn't say he was going to pass away, you know, but what he was doing is he got sober and he was trying to make an amends to me. You know, before he had passed away. And he was trying to tell me that I had a brother and a sister. He was telling me about his side of the family and just trying to catch me up on everything the best that he could. And I get to that line, and he says, it says, Michael, it's not that I didn't want you. It's that I was an alcoholic, but I've been delivered of my alcoholism for the last 6.5 years by my Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. And he said, on March 12th, I'll have 7 years sober. And I've always said that March 11th was my sobriety date because when I went into the treatment center, I thought like you couldn't be drunk or nothing to get in there. I had no idea, you know, and it's actually preferable that you're wasted. But I tried to like sober up or whatever, and so I always kind of counted that date. But March 12th was my first day in that treatment center, like my first day like where I was pulled out of the hell that I was living. And that's my dad's sobriety date. You know, it's like I was blown away. He would have 21 years if he was still alive today. But and here's the guy that I thought I'd never have anything in common with. You know, I never knew him. I was so angry. At one point, I wanted to go to his grave and yell at him and all this stuff and then tell him I love him and everything. I didn't know how to feel. And it was like, bang, I was just like blown away by that. And that really opened me up to even more of like, you know, what really happens? I mean, what happens when we pass away? I mean, did he help me? Did he guide me into that? You know, I don't know. I have quite a lot of friends who passed away. More recently, my nephew, and he and I, his name was Dwayne. We used to drink together. You know, we were vicious alcoholics together. We fueled each other like neck and neck. And when I got sober, he was like one of the first people I thought about. And, you know, he kind of had made some attempts at this. And like about 3 months ago, he had passed away. And it was horrible. Like my sister was actually in the hospital for an emergency appendix surgery, and the coroner's office called her like her next day in recovery and said, you know, we found your son, and you know, she's like crying and wailing, and you know, it was hard. It was really, it's so hard, like, because we were like really close. We're only about a year apart, and it was tough to listen to my sister cry like that. To listen to not only my sister, but a mother. Like, that sound is just, you know, you can't forget that, you know. But that's what happens to us. That's the pain that we have waiting if I'm not going to give myself simply to this program, you know, just give who I am to this thing that's saved my life countless times. But, you know, I kind of look at it like he's with me. You know, I've always kind of looked at it like that with my dad even. Friends of mine have passed away. It's amazing, like, how sometimes you'll just have an open seat, you know, next to you, and I just kind of feel like he's there with me. Or if we say the Lord's Prayer after the meeting and nobody's standing next to me, I always hold my hand out. And there's all these different ways that I can kind of carry him with me, and, you know, he is with me. My dad's with me. Like, whoever you've lost, I feel like they're with us. You know, I don't know, this spirit thing, this awakening, like, that I've had, like, being alive and, you know, as much as I can understand it and feel it, it's so big that how can I limit it to say like it just goes away or whatever? I don't really know. You know, I don't know what happens, but it's nice to, I guess, honor these people's memory that way for me. But, you know, I've had so many great experiences and moments in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have to say, like, there's times too where I've fallen off, you know, around when I was 5 years sober. My sponsor and I and a couple people are here. We actually got together and we started this, my home group today. And I started out as the treasurer, and I was trying to like back out of it and say like, no, I don't think I really want to do that, because I wasn't really too good at managing my money around this time. And they decided I was good enough to manage their money. So everything was going well for the first couple months. And then I had this mobile banking app thing on my phone with both accounts like linked to it. And my fiance says one night after I'm coming out of the meeting, you know, hey, Molly doesn't have any diapers. You know, can you stop and get some? And I'm like not budgeting my money well. And I look into my account and there's not enough in there to go get the box of diapers. So I say to myself, like, okay, well, what I'll do is I'll just transfer $20 out of my home group's account into my personal account, and I'll pay it tomorrow. I get, you know, paid tomorrow. It's Friday. You know, I'll do it. They would want me to do that, you know. And if I was, like, talking to a sponsee and he said that awesome plan to me, I'd be like, no. Like, you're nuts. Like, you either get off your ego pedestal and ask some of the home group members if this is okay, or you just lower your pride and ask somebody, yo, can I borrow $20? Like, I need to go grab diapers. But I'm too afraid, and I was too full of myself at this time. I had just, like, gotten, like, 5 years around that time. I don't know if I'm still holding on to my marble bag or whatever the heck. But so I go ahead and I do this, and it works well because, you know, the next day I put the $20 in the account. Oh, yeah, great. But what happened is I broke the water on that one, so it worked so well the first time I did it again and then again and then with bigger bills. And it got to the point, long story short, where I owed $1,400 to my home group. Yeah, that was a tough thing. Right. So it was crazy, and I'm going nuts in my head. Like, because at one point I had two jobs. Then I stopped working at the second job, and my hours at the primary job got cut back. So now I don't even have enough money coming in to actually pay it back. And I'll tell you, for about 6 months, I sat with knowing what I had to do, knowing what the right thing is to do, which was to get honest with my home group, forfeit from being the treasurer and set up a payment plan, and the fear of actually being able to do that. Because I start going into my head like crazy. What are they're going to kick me out of AA. What about my reputation as an alcoholic in this anonymous fellowship? You know, all this different crazy stuff, you know, and I'm dying. I would come home and I wouldn't even be able to spend time with my kids. I would just go upstairs and I'd try to just go to sleep. And I wound up throughout the whole thing, after I finally got honest about it, I wound up getting even fired from the first job because I was so stressed out. I'd be arguing with my boss, who's like this, he was this awesome guy just trying to help me out. I'd argue with him and be like the worst employee ever, you know, because I'm like in my head the whole time. How are you going to pay this back? I hate you. You know, I hate myself, all this stuff. And I didn't have alcohol to take it away. And, but you know, we had this speaker come out and, he was just saying this stuff that really just, again, it was like the guy in the rehab, just direct line right to my heart. And he helped me sit with my sponsor. And I got honest and got honest with the group, forfeited the position and set up a payment plan and paid it back. You know, and so I bumped my head in this program. You know, and to close, like, you know, I don't have to be perfect, you know, but I definitely have to not try to do this thing by myself. It has been my experience. And keep myself open to the other people around me and not listen to that stuff, especially if I'm like, this is where an inventory is important, because I really need to see whether I'm really being honest or not. And when I'm not being honest, I can't see nothing. I'm like blind. And I tell myself a whole bunch of stuff, you know, really bad stuff. And I think people are thinking about something about me that's not even true. And I keep pushing myself further and further away. And I start judging people in the fellowship. And I judge this person and that person. And I cut myself off. So doing a regular inventory is like a godsend. You know, that's why they ask us, you know, suggest for us to do it. And telling other people, doing this 10th step, you know, doing this nightly review, you know, practicing prayer and meditation maybe. You know, keeping myself open. Like just being honest with people, having a couple people that I can run stuff by is imperative for me today. Because without that, I'm alone and I can't do this by myself. You know, but I don't have to. I don't have to live that life anymore. That's what is given to us here. So like to anybody who's new, if you haven't gotten a sponsor yet, please get a sponsor. If you have a sponsor and you're kind of sitting on whatever step it is, maybe take the initiative, you know, go read through the big book, call your sponsor tonight, you know, just try. I mean, what do you have to lose, really? That awkward feeling that you're sitting on? Because do you really want that? You know, we have freedom. So take it. Thanks for letting me share.
Hey, everybody. My name's Mickey. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey.
So, Mike, thanks so much, man. Actually, I don't really know what to say now because you took everything I was going to say about him during your message here. No, really. It was awesome. You know, God grants us this opportunity to come in and get sober. We get a loving and caring God, and then we get good sponsorship, and then we get to meet good people, and we get to surround ourselves with good people that love us and care about us and want nothing in return. And I've been fortunate enough now to give this gentleman his anniversary coin last year and this year again. From the bottom of my heart, I am extremely grateful to have him in my life. He's an incredible person. He's got a wonderful program. So please help me congratulate Kyle on 4 years of sobriety.
thanks a lot. I don't know, every year this like comes up, and first of all, I can't believe it's another year. And second of all, I just like, it's been 4 years since I wanted to die every day when I woke up. And it's been, you know, like Mike said, man, it's like 4 years that I'm like, I can show up today. I'm a son, and I'm a brother, and I'm an employee, and I'm a friend. And like, God and AA taught me that. I owe it all to the people in these rooms and to God, because without that, I'd probably be dead by now. So if you feel like that, man, come see one of us after the meeting, because like, you don't have to feel like that anymore. You know, life throws curveballs at you sometimes, but like, AA showed me that you can get through anything. So that's all I got. Thanks for letting me share.